Well, good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Flockster coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. And we put in a new air conditioner. I cannot tell you how happy I am about that. And it sure feels good. And here we go. Okay. We are a week away, amazingly, from Rosh Hashanah. This is it. A week from today is the first day of the holiday. And Rabbi Alt, the new assistant rabbi here in the shul, quoted the Arizal, famous Arizal, who said that in the last week of the year, the last Sunday of the year can be misaken all the Sundays. The last Monday of the year can fix up all the Mondays of the year. You get it. So this is the last Monday of the year. Let's try our best to do what we can to fix up this whole week to have made the whole year worthwhile. And it reminds me of a very famous quote of the Satmar Rav. It's only appropriate to quote the Satmar Rav in a book that's dedicated to Mizrahi ideals. The Satmar Rav said on a few parshios ago, when Moshe Rabbeinu said, the eyes... The eyes of God are upon the land of Israel, Mereshis Hashana, from the beginning of the year, that Achrishana until the end of the year. Ask the Satmar Rav, what kind of grammar is that? Mereshis Hashana, from the beginning of the year, should then follow that Achris Hashana until the end of the year. Or go the other way. But either way, don't mix and match. Don't say, oh, the beginning of the year until the end of a year. It's very weird. Answers the Satmar Rav, it's like this. That's the way human beings are. At the beginning of the year, everybody is putting out those Jewish resolutions. Oh, I'm going to learn more Torah. Oh, man, I'm going to do more chesed. Oh, am I going to daven? Finally, Shmon Esrei the Kavanah. That's a problem with me. After doing it 55,000 times, I immediately go into space right after Atzah Kadosh. I mean, immediately. And then I chop myself at Shema Kolenu, and I pray for other people. And Refrainu, I pray for people. And then before I know it, I'm taking three steps back. And like, what was that all about? And where did I go? I went around the world in my head. It's a problem. It's a problem. When you say something again and again over the course of your life, it just becomes automatic. It is a problem. The point is, Rabbi Yoelish says, at the beginning of the year, everybody says, this is going to be my year. Oh, this is the year. Oh, boy. Watch my smoke. I'm going to get married this year. I'm going to get a promotion this year. I'm going to have a baby this year. I'm going to move on with my life this year. I'm going to graduate this year. I'm going to get my first job this year. Wow, what a year. This is going to be the year that I make all these good moves. After about 5 or 7 or 10 months into the year, you look back and you say, what happened? Nothing panned out. I didn't get the promotion. I'm not engaged yet. I therefore don't have a baby on the way yet, hopefully. You get the idea. Things become just so petered out that it becomes a year like every other year was. So even though it started out as this is going to be the year, Hashanah, the year, sadly, at the end of the year, it becomes Shana, like any other 12-month period, without fulfilling all the desires and promises and resolutions that you made. Very little came of it. You didn't daven better. You didn't learn too much. Chesed wasn't really on your radar. You didn't get that promotion. You didn't get engaged. And it's painful. Can I say it's painful? Says me, and of course the Satmar Rebbe would approve, in the spirit of the Arizal, guess what? You've got 1 week left. We all have 1 week left to make it right. As Springsteen would sing, I got one more chance to make it real. We're going to be seeing Springsteen on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Or Shlomo Carbach and Springsteen as Baalei Machshava, and how what they have to say about Rosh Hashanah. Plenty, by the way. Come to the class here in Gulf Manor Synagogue, Cincinnati. Friends, you've got 7 days to turn this around. Starting right now, this class, you pay attention. And you daven better. And you factor in some chesed. May I suggest that you start giving blood. Give blood this week. Believe me, you truly want that on your resume when you stand in front of God. And he'll say, what did you do this year? And you'll say, well, not a whole lot, but I did give blood once. And God will say, you gave blood? Wow, you saved a human being's life? That's big. You saved the life of one of my children in the world? Very good. So you want that. Increased kavana, more limud Torah, more chesed starting right now. So here we are. Let's get started. We're learning Torah. Rabbi Berlov and his wife are away for Simchas. May they have Simchas. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to do a little portion of a book called Seeking His Presence, Conversations with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal, former Rosh Yeshiva of the Gush in Alon Shvut. He had a PhD at Harvard in English literature, a fascinating human being, a deeply learned, complex man. And let's hear what he has to say about the state of Israel. And then we're going to combine that with Professor Rabbi Dr. Isidore Twersky. If I'm not mistaken, it's certainly Rabbi Lichtenstein, who was the son-in-law of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And I believe Professor Twersky was as well. So two heavy-hitting scholars will weigh in on the state of Israel. You don't hear from these men very much in certain circles like they don't exist. In Haredi and Yeshivish circles, these men are ignored. When you ignore somebody, you don't have to deal with them. People around here ignore me, so they feel they don't have to deal with me. But you can't ignore me for long. I keep chattering and squawking and squawking. And these men were very deep thinkers. They wrote stuff. You want to ignore it? It's at your peril. You have to account. You have to factor. They're also a Bar Hachi. They're a Bar Deya. You can't just ignore though you'd like to. In this book, which Rabbi Balk sold me, Seeking His Presence, with Rabbi Conversations of the Lichtenstein, and the chapter called To Seize the Staff of History on Zionism and the State of Israel. Let's begin. It is a conversation between a Rabbi Sabato, an Israeli who has his Egyptian roots. He was born in Egypt, came to Israel as a child, learned in Yeshivat HaKotel, served in the IDF, founded Yeshivat Hezder Birkat Moshe in Ma'ale Adumim, and he's taught there ever since. He's written books, and this one was written originally in Hebrew, translated into English. Isn't that something? And it had to be worked on. The English had to be worked on a little bit by people who knew him to make it sound like Rabbi Lichtenstein would have said it in English. Says Rabbi Sabato, when the Zionist movement was established, its religious opponents raised two principled objections. One objection was that the very notion of trying to establish a state posed a risk to the Jewish people and was furthermore prohibited because it violates one of the three oaths that the nation of Israel was sworn to when they went into exile, that they not ascend as a wall. That is, en masse. See the Gemara Ksubas 111a. We spent a lot of time in that Gemara before we started Eim HaMasmecha. He continues, Rabbi Sabato is the interrogator, if you will. Redemption must come from heaven, is the opinion of these Haredim, and seeking to establish a state could only cause damage. The second objection was that since the leaders of the Zionist movement were not observant, there was a concern that the Jewish people would become a secular nation. They were concerned that the Zionist movement would divert the focal point of the nation from religious to nationalist, or in the worst case, that the religious identity of the Jewish nation would be uprooted. How do you relate to these claims? Answers Rabbi Lichtenstein. I wish I could tell you that all we dreamt of in returning to Zion has come true. I wish I could tell you that all the problems and concerns have been resolved and that all is just as it should be. I wish I could feel that we have arrived El Haaretz El HaMenucha Vel HaNachla, to the rest and to the inheritance. Paskin Devarim, Deuteronomy 12:9. I feel that we arrived diplomatically. I wish I could feel that we have arrived diplomatically, politically, societally, spiritually, in terms of sanctity, Torah, and fear of heaven. But I don't want to deceive you, says Rabbi Lichtenstein. Even if I wanted to, I would not be able to. You would see through it. But that is not the crucial question. The question is not whether we deal properly with the spiritual and societal challenges and whether we are progressing, ascending along the proper spiritual path with the Jewish people advancing from one success to the next. The deficiencies of the state in which we live today are too wide-ranging and too deep for us to be able to delude ourselves or others, even if we wanted to. The claims that you mentioned, the claims of the opponents of Zionism, are of two types. There is the theological question of whether we are authorized to take up the staff of history to advance matters based on our human understanding and capability. This question does not relate solely to the assessment of the state, but to the understanding of the place of man vis-a-vis the Almighty on the historical plane. The Zionist position, adopted by the rabbis and other religious adherents of the movement as well, believed not only that man is capable and authorized to take up this mantle, but that man is obligated to do so. He is obligated to fashion an optimal world, both spiritually and physically. They believed that of all options available to the Jewish people at that time, this initiative was the best alternative, not the perfect alternative. And surely, it has been proven to be even less perfect than they thought. But they believed that this was the best chance to safeguard the identity of the Jewish people in quantity, in strength, and in ideas. Asks Rabbi Sabato, how do you respond to the second objection? Namely, that the establishment of the state by non-religious leadership weakens the nation religiously. Says Rabbi Lichtenstein, I do not deny the fact that, in a certain sense, the very founding of a state can lead some to veer from Jewish tradition, from faith. There is no doubt that economic prosperity brings with it certain dangers. There is significant economic prosperity in the state of Israel against the prognostications. Not everyone gets a piece of the pie, but there is a pie. There is no doubt that this blossoming affords opportunity for rebelliousness against God. As we know from the Torah itself, but Yeshurun grew fat and kicked. Vayishman Yeshurun vayivot. Deuteronomy, Devarim 32, verse 15. Furthermore, we live in an era when man's faith in his own power and abilities is rampant. This faith characterizes the modern culture generally, in contrast to the sense of dependence that was dominant until the 17th century, at the end of the Renaissance. Back then, the wider world still believed, or at least paid lip service to the idea, that there was someone running the world, Today, to my sorrow, many have abandoned this faith, and the risks are great. But let's make no mistake, as many do in many realms, including diplomacy, they tell you to avoid actions because of the possible risks, as though one who rests on his laurels runs no risks, and his life grows and prospers. Life is full of risks, both on the individual and national levels. Rabbi Lichtenstein continues in this book, seeking his presence. I'm on page 227 in the book. There are different perspectives on how to perceive the world in which one lives. I mean this not only ideologically, but existentially, viscerally. The Musa literature brims with vivid descriptions of the entire world as one big minefield. They warn us that anywhere we turn, we may falter. That Sheva Yikom Tzadik, a just man falls, not merely seven times, like the Pasuk in Proverbs said, 24:16, but rather he falls 77 times. I come from a different school of thought, says Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, one that indeed sees the world as containing many stumbling blocks and pitfalls, both in the public sphere and in the private realm, but which perceives the world mainly as an arena of creativity and activity. It sees the possibilities of building up the world, the nation, and the individual. Excuse me. And by the way, I see it the same way. I'm allowed to agree with him. Growing up, I remember learning some Musar here and there. Then I went to Chappelle's. And Rav Feigenman was always talking about creativity. I never heard much about the world being just filled with minefields. Then in the second year, Rav Shurin gave us a class in Rav Yisrael Salanter and his Musar and his Machshava. But I don't remember all the negativity. I don't remember that. I remember the 3 years or so that I learned Yeshiva in Israel and Chappelle's being tremendously uplifting. It was never depressing. Plus, I didn't understand Pshat and the Gemara. Then that was a little bit depressing. But we never harped on this is a minefield and this is a battleground and everything's terrible. I don't remember that. I didn't learn that. Rabbi Lichtenstein continues. The English poet Keats did not have a lot of time in his life to philosophize, as he died at the age of 25. He wrote in one of his letters that the world is a veil of soul-making. I do not generally speak of the general soul, in Rav Kook's terminology, but of Jewish souls, of Jewish lives. Our world is the realm in which such lives are fashioned. I am told that there is a danger that in the state of Israel, people will stray from the proper path. Let us ask ourselves whether this danger emerged with the establishment of the state, with the establishment of the state of Israel. We know the truth. We know Jewish history. Take the most beautiful, wonderful, splendid communities. Take Warsaw, that was flush with the Hasidim of Ger. What became of it? Even before the Holocaust, what happened to the splendid cities of Lithuania in the first part of the 20th century? People had wonderful lives, but the feeling that everything could continue on as it was without confronting the new challenges that arose in the modern era, this feeling was illusory. Indeed, we must come to terms with the fact that life itself is full of risks. The question is, do we submit to the risks or do we grapple with the opportunities? I do not assert, as certain people do, says Rabbi Lichtenstein, that there is more Torah today in Bnei Brak than ever was anywhere, or that in Meir Shearim there is greater piety than there was in cities in Europe. Nor do I say the opposite. I don't waste my time debating such people. But I will tell you honestly that I have difficulty understanding how people can speak with such hubris after the Holocaust. How can people say even, I'm sorry, how can people say either that if it weren't for Zionism, the destruction would have been even greater, or that the destruction came because of Zionism? I know people of great stature who claim that the Holocaust came about because the nation of Israel abandoned the Torah of Israel and the like. They assert this with great understanding and deep thought. But where do they get this confidence? I think that we need to be aware that there are grave dangers in encountering the world, and facing them takes tremendous responsibility. But we must not retreat from great responsibility. On the contrary, we must strive to meet the challenge to the best of our abilities, to intensify our energies, to propel forward, and to strengthen our educational efforts. Asks Rabbi Sabato, there are those who see the spiritual condition of the state of Israel after over 60 years, and they wonder, is this the child for whom we prayed? See 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 27, where Hannah says, this is the child for whom I prayed. How can one respond to them? Some are very critical of the state of Israel. Says Rabbi Lichtenstein, sometimes it is helpful to focus on the full part of the glass, even if the glass is not half full. We should note that both in the diaspora and in Israel, the Jewish community is great in numbers and blessed with great depth and strength, involved in Torah and developing it. The land of Israel is filled with people who are building a society, which is in many ways a Torah-based moral society. This is all part of the partly full glass. In truth, this is more than half full. Many among us lack patience, says Rabbi Lichtenstein. I follow the model of the four cups. In the Talmud and the Rishonim, there is a discussion concerning the four cups of wine on the Seder night. Whether it is one mitzvah or four separate mitzvahs. Some of the commentaries address the question of what to do if one is just one cup rather than four. Some maintain that if you don't have four cups, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah at all. Others say that while the four fringes of the tzitzis are interdependent, as are the four passages included in the tefillin, there's no source indicating the same with regard to the four cups. That is to say, they could be independent of each other. There are four cups of redemption. There are both terrible things and wonderful things being done in the state. One must recognize the wonderful things and try to navigate the difficult things. By the way, the difficult things in the state of Israel are not all limited to talis and tefillin, ritual baths and kashrus. The violence that we witness, the social and economic discrepancies between different segments of the population, the pursuit of money on the part of people who, even if they were to live four times as long as Methuselah, would not have the time to spend the money they seize. These are all terrible things. I am far from seeing reality with rose-colored glasses. But the good that exists should not be denied. And there is a lot of good. The fact that not everyone maintains the lifestyle we would want causes much sorrow. But we cannot just throw up our hands in despair. I like to quote the author of the Tanya, Rashnir Zalman of Liadi, who said that one must not give up on a Jew, and a Jew must not give up. I have no delusions about this. Before I made Aliyah, I responded to a Jew who wrote me a cautionary letter about my Aliyah. I wrote to him saying that I am making Aliyah with my eyes and heart wide open. I assume that the situation may get worse and not improve. But all the same, I want to be there in a place where I can try to influence the future. Asks Rabbi Sabato, you emphasize the need to proceed despite the risks and the obligation to take responsibility from a personal standpoint. What about the broader historical perspective of a nation returning to its homeland, self-rule, and self-determination? Answers Rabbi Lichtenstein, the point that the Rav used to emphasize was that the arena of the nation of Israel is the historical international arena. There are special opportunities in terms of how the Jewish people act in relation to the nations of the world, all the while maintaining its own unique identity, encouraging its spirit, values, and perspective. These are opportunities which come along both at the political level and at the social level. Asks Rabbi Sabato, but can one say that the Zionist leadership properly navigated these opportunities? Answers Rabbi Lichtenstein, the prophets, the great leaders of the nation, had sharp criticism for the establishment, for the monarchs. The greatest prophets expressed their rage. They transmitted the anger of the Almighty. And this rage was understandable. But do you hear Amos saying, the prophet Amos, do you hear him saying that the monarchy must be discontinued? There are references to the three sins of Israel and the four sins of Israel. There are particular places in the Bible where the kings and the establishment are threatened. But one must recall that in the days of the first temple, corruption and idol worship were rather widespread. And nonetheless, the prophets did not tell the kings of Israel to hand over the keys to the king of Assyria. They didn't do that. They didn't say that. Nobody said, hey, commit social suicide. Time to disintegrate. The truth is that there is great pain in pondering the state of Israel because the disappointment is so great. Many say sincerely that this is not the child for whom we prayed. But would we be better off without this child altogether? Would we be better off barren? No! We must raise families in the national sense with the visage of Jacob Israel emblazoned upon their foreheads, and pray for improvement in this regard. I prefer, in the conditions under which we live today, to live with exaggerated appreciation for Zionism, rather than to show a lack of appreciation for it. When I arrive in the world of truth, I would prefer to be asked why I gave Ben-Gurion credit for what he did, rather than be asked why I did not give him the credit he deserved. This is a theological question. Allow me to summarize what I said earlier. I was raised to believe that man must act to the best of his ability, without arrogance or hubris, with total recognition of the majesty of heaven, with all that this implies. We must always be aware that, like the Pasuk in Tehillim says, 115, verse 16, he has given the earth to the children of men. We didn't simply receive a land. We received a land that requires care and development. And this labor, with all the risks involved, is our responsibility. We must accept this responsibility upon ourselves and bear all the accompanying consequences. We must seize the staff of history. Rabbi Sabato now is going to quote Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he'll mention Rav Kook as well. So here goes. Rabbi Sabato says, you spoke about seizing the staff of history. You mentioned the fact that the establishment of the state was the best diplomatic move with certain attendant risks for the nation of Israel at that time. But there is so much more to the establishment of the state than that. It is the realization of the dream of generations, of the visions of the prophets. It's the beginning of the redemption. I presume he says, the Eskalt of the Geula, though I don't have the Hebrew in front of me. It is the beginning of the redemption, according to Rabbi Sabato. After all, we see with our own eyes the fulfillment of the promises concerning the settling of the land and its blossoming, the ingathering of the exiles of Israel from the four corners of the earth, and a restoration of sovereignty. It's clear that Rav Kook's followers see the establishment of an independent Israel as much more than a diplomatic arrangement to save Jews. They see it as an historical event that realizes the vision of the prophets. But even when your teacher and mentor of Soloveitchik wrote about this in his essay, Kol Dodi Dofek, he spoke of six heavenly knocks that were heard with the establishment of the State of Israel. As he writes there, God, who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness, suddenly manifested himself and began to knock at the tent of his despondent and disconsolate love, twisting convulsively on her bed, suffering the pains of hell. As a result of the knocks on the door of the maiden, wrapped in mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, Avelus, the State of Israel was born. Thus far, you have not mentioned anything of this type. Answers Rabbi Lichtenstein, I don't know to what degree the essay Kol Dodi Dofek reflects the Rav's approach throughout his life. I would assume that Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Zichron Levracha, would wake up in the morning, take in the sounds of the State of Israel, and experience the State of Israel. The Rav, Zichron Levracha, did not wake up in the morning with this deep feeling. Kol Dodi Dofek was a very successful work, but it reflects a certain spirit, things that were said on Israel's Independence Day, at a time when the state was beginning to strike roots, but had not yet burst into full flower. It was at such a moment that the Rav said what he said. Those who claimed that he was against Zionist policy or an anti-Zionist were mistaken. He identified with Zionism. What is correct is that the theological component associated with the establishment of the state was not at the forefront of his thought. For me, since we made Aliyah, I have been more existentially connected to the state than the Rav was. Yet I still would not approach it with the celebratory tones of Hegelian historical knocking. And finally, the last excerpt, this is from his book, Kismachtani, maybe it's a collection of essays, Kismachtani Hashem Befo Lecha. You have gladdened me, O God, through your work. He writes, we would be seized with horror if we were to ask ourselves what the Jewish world would be like today were it not for the State of Israel, without a feeling of pride in the existence of the state, without those symbols with which we can identify him. What a vacuum this would leave. If the state had not yet been founded, an individual liberal that does not fully identify with Judaism religiously would assimilate. There would be isolated strongholds, but nothing more than that. In one sense, the state was established in 1948, but in another sense, it is reestablished daily. Every single day, God's handiwork is revealed anew. The continuing existence of one lamb among 70 wolves, and today there are more than 70, is a revelation of the work of God on a daily basis, renewed every morning. Ought we not be amazed by this and glorify in it? For you, O God, has made me through your work. B'masi Yadecha Aramin. Okay. That is Rabbi Lichtenstein. I hope you enjoyed that. I promised you a little bit about Rabbi Tversky. Not so much quotes like Rabbi Lichtenstein, but a little bit about his life. Rabbi Dr. Isidore Yitzchak Tversky was the chairman of the board of Harvard's Middle East Studies or Near Eastern Literature or Judaic Studies Department, and he ran it for many, many years. Professor Mark Shapiro was his very last PhD student, Professor Shapiro told me. I did not have the chance to really get to know him. In the mid-90s, I was a student at BU Law School. Boston University Law School. I lived on top of Chai Adam, a very warm, friendly Lakewood-style shul. Used to daven at the Rebbe's once in a while, at the Kollel once in a while. And I went to Talner, the Talner-based Medrash, where Rabbi Twersky was the rabbi, I think only once. I may have davened Shabbos Mincha there. I did not introduce myself. I did not get a chance to meet this man. I didn't go to Harvard when I was there for the whole year. I mean, I went to Harvard, but I didn't go to the Judaic department and meet him and hang out in the library over there and meet the PhD candidates. I didn't do that. I was busy with my own program, and I feel bad. At all events, it was what it was. And this man was a great man, and we'll read a little bit about him. While Rabbi Twersky was born and lived his whole life in Boston, this is an article by Carmi Horowitz, an appreciation of his teacher, Professor Isidore Twersky. While Rabbi Twersky was born and lived his whole life in Boston, special note should be taken of his connection and relationship to Israel and to Zionism. Although he was not a card-carrying member of any Zionist organization, he maintained a deep religious, ideological, and existential commitment to Eretz Yisrael, to the state of Israel, and to the Zionist ideal. I should first note his close personal tie with Eretz Yisrael, which expressed itself in frequent visits to Israel and close relationships with a wide variety of Israelis, Hasidim and Talmid HaChachamim, scholars and thinkers, literary figures, simple individuals, and Israeli presidents. He looked forward to his trips to Israel, and there was an obvious serenity about him when he was there. He even had concrete plans before he passed away for opening a Beit Midrash in Jerusalem. In his capacity of director of the Center for Jewish Studies at Harvard, he cemented ties with dozens of Israeli scholars in all branches of Jewish studies by providing fellowships at the center to enable them to do research and advance their careers. Professor Bernard Septimus pointed out to me that he did more than any other American scholar to establish connections with Israeli scholars and scholarship in the realm of Jewish studies. He maintained close ties with the Hebrew University, and particularly with its Institute for Jewish Studies, and headed the summer school of the Institute for Advanced Studies, bringing young scholars to Jerusalem for an intensive week of scholarly lectures in Judaic studies. A year and a half before his passing, he was awarded an honorary doctorate by the Hebrew University. He was cited as, quote, a renowned authority on medieval Hebrew literature and Jewish thought, and the leading researcher in Jewish studies in the United States. The mentor of several generations of scholars and researchers investigating aspects of Jewish intellectual heritage, through his charismatic leadership, Professor Twersky has imbued in his students both the enthusiasm and profundity of scholarly approach, which are his hallmark. His wealth of expertise in Judaic studies combines with his expansive general knowledge and broad intellect to create an inspiring teacher, prolific writer, and innovative researcher. In addition, Professor Twersky wrote two articles in particular which reflect his thinking on Eretz Israel and Zionism. In his article, Maimonides on Eretz Israel, Halachic, Philosophic, and Historical Perspectives, Rabbi Twersky, with persistence, ingenuity, and insight, discovered a wide variety of contexts that can be used to measure Maimonidean positions on Eretz Israel. Although Rabbi Twersky dealt with Maimonidean thinking on many issues, and is therefore not surprising they investigated this aspect as well, only a person with the kind of existential commitment to Eretz Israel that he had would so patiently reveal so many different kinds of sources and so many different contexts, all throwing light on some aspect of the importance, centrality, or function of Eretz Israel. such topics as the spread of monotheism, the history of halakha, the history of philosophy, the history of prophecy, prayer, the Hebrew language, the authority of the Sanhedrin, the monarchy, are all building blocks that construct the edifice of Maimonidean conceptions of Eretz Yisrael. Not only Eretz Yisrael as an idea and as a halakha construct, but the state of Israel as a political reality, and Zionism as an issue of contemporary concern, also drew his intense interest and attention. In an article he titled Survival, Normalcy, Modernity, Professor Tversky presented his thoughts on the future of the Jewish people, on the centrality of the State of Israel, and the impact of modernity on Judaism. It was an unusual type of article for Professor Tversky. It was not a scholarly annotated piece such as he usually wrote. In the article, he states that the establishment of the State of Israel made a critical contribution to Jewish survival. The Zionist movement and the state that was established in its wake contributed to the balance between national existence with its political dimensions and spiritual existence with its cultural heritage. Zionism indeed contributed to righting the imbalance of an exclusive spiritual existence without a political national base. However, if Zionism sees itself as seeking to replace the spiritual cultural heritage of Judaism and the Jewish people, if Zionism sees itself as seeking to replace the spiritual cultural heritage of Judaism and the Jewish people with an alternative ideology, detached from the past and indeed negating it, one must counter with a broad conception of Judaism which draws from the wellsprings of tradition and continues the spiritual and cultural creativity of past generations, and which understands that, quote, modern Judaism and Judaism in chains are two completely different concepts. Wow. Modern Judaism is imperialistic and attempts to impose modern cultural values on Judaism while rejecting traditional Jewish values. Judaism in modern times is a chronological term which, while positively valuing contemporary Jewish creativity and political accomplishments, does not detach them from the rich heritage of the past. Even traditional Jewish thinkers in modern times have much to say that is new, and an up-to-date picture of Judaism, which includes figures such as the Netziv of Volozhin and Rav Kook, has the potential of drawing Jews back to a life of belief and Torah observance. Tversky had complete confidence in the ultimate survival of the Jewish people, although in the diaspora, it will be a mere Sheiris HaPleitah who will survive. But while normal political existence permits survival, true survival will only be a function of our success in showing that Judaism is alive and vital, that observant Jews are individuals with high ethical behavior, and their actions sanctify God's name. Only by perpetuating this kind of Judaism within the state that the Zionist movement established can its survival be ensured. Okay? Wanted to read that to you. Good. Done. And now we can do a few pages of Ein Banim Smecha. So let's turn to page 321, if you have the book. You know, sorry about last week. I misread my watch. I cheated you out of 10 minutes. For that, I apologize. We're on the bottom of 321, little chapter, Lamed Tes 39. Behold, I write these words at a time when we still suffer the hardships of exile, surrounded on all sides by fear and dismay, in every corner and on every side of the camp of Israel, one can hear sounds and yearnings to return to the land of our inheritance. Top of 322. To rebuild the city's walls and to raise our holy land from the heaps of dust. However, there is reason to fear that after the harsh decrees subside, with God's help, and the lands of exile return to their original strength, thereby ushering in a time of rest and tranquility for Israel, the Jews will once again content themselves with their original situation and remain in Gaulis. All the more so, if they find a good business or a good means of support here, they will reconsider returning to Israel and use various excuses to once again cling to their stepmother and betray their true mother. They will fool themselves into thinking that their stepmother will be better to them this time, and they will relapse into their old flaw of neglecting Eretz Yisrael. This concurs with something I heard from my beloved friend, the brilliant and righteous rabbi, our master of Yisrael David Margolis Schlesinger. The Baal Turim cites in Mesorah, Vayachtalu, the thunder ceased, and Vayachtalu Livnos Sa'ir, they ceased to build the city. Okay. The Baal Turim cites in Mesorah, the thunder ceased, Vayachtalu. That's in the seventh plague of Barad, of hail, in Shmos, Exodus chapter 9, verse 33. And the same verb, Vayachtalu, comes up in the Migdal Bavel, in the building of the Tower of Babel. Vayachtalu of Nosaseya, they ceased building the city. So what is thunder ceasing in ancient Egypt have to do with the people in Bavel building some sort of temple or tower? It's true. Both psukim feature the verb vayachtalu. But you know what? That's about as far as I would go. No, I'm wrong. Rabbi Schlesinger explained that as long as the thunder and cries of the harsh decrees can still be heard, may God protect us, the Jews awaken themselves to build the holy city. As long as the thunder and cries of harsh decrees are heard, Jews awaken themselves to build Jerusalem. But when the thunder ceases, like the Pasuk says, Vayachtalu, when the thunder ceases, and they decrease themselves, and the decrees themselves subside, then the Jews cease to build the city. They return to their original places and become enamored with their situation in the diaspora, as in the past. That's a fascinating midrash, because one verb, Vayachtalu, has to do with, thunder and stuff, and it's the seventh plague, and it wasn't affecting the Jews anyway. It only affected the Egyptians. I'm going to write that down. And didn't affect the Jews, unless it did. Can anybody tell me? And then to say, oh, Vayachtalu, oh, that's got to do with building the holy city of Yerushalayim. Really? But that Vayachtalu is talking about how they stopped building Migdal Bavel, a rebellion against God. I know that we're doing drush over here, but aren't there any limits? Where are the parameters? I know that Vayachtalu, I mean, it's nice, but I don't know what else to make of it. So this is very creative, but I don't know if it's Eisgehalten. So anyway, his point is that as soon as people stop hearing the thunder and the lightning, as soon as the lightning and the thunder stops, then the Jews stop building the city. Vayachtalu, vayachtalu. The thunder stops, the Jews stop. Okay, it's creative, all right. Just don't know if it's really 100%, he said it's got to be okay, but strikes me as, we're talking about Migdal Bavel one second, now we're talking about the Jewish people. It's a bit of a stretch. Rabbi Tachler writes, therefore I say that we must caution our fellow Jews who have gone through this calamitous period, and we must remind them of the following Mishnah. And here it is on the top of page 323. If a man copulates with an animal, or a woman brings an animal upon herself, both the human and the animal are executed by stoning. Now, granted, the man sinned, but what sin did the animal commit? Well, since it caused the man to stumble, the Torah said that it should be stoned. Another explanation, we stone it so that the animal should not walk around the marketplace where people will say, oh, this is the animal that caused so-and-so to be stoned. He writes, and that all that is from Sanhedrin 54b. In addition, the Talmud and the Rambam determine that one is forbidden to derive benefit from a sword with which a person was executed, even though it helped fulfill the mitzvah of you shall destroy the evil from your midst. It's completely forbidden since a man was killed with it. All the more so when it's forbidden to derive any benefit from a sword that killed its master. Okay? Thus the Torah says that something which causes a man to stumble, or which might cause people to say, this is what caused so-and-so to be stoned, is completely forbidden. Therefore, it's forbidden for us to derive benefit from these countries anymore, because they have caused Klal Yisrael tremendous misfortune, especially in our times. Moreover, how can we continue to walk around these countries and say, here and there, so-and-so and so-and-so were killed, burned, stoned, plundered, and abducted? There's not a single Jewish family in which one of its members was not ensnared in their trap, a father, a brother, a son, or a daughter. Hundreds, if not thousands. Hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands have perished, as is well known throughout the world. How is it possible to look at these places anymore? How can anyone with any pure emotions associate with such places after they poured contempt and disgrace upon us? They afflicted us so intensely that nothing in our entire history can compare to it. We must mention this and similar ideas to the survivors of this exile in order to awaken them. Furthermore, it's well known that a mark remains on a place where a person was killed or injured. An evil spirit rests there and lies in wait for other human souls. The Yalkut comments on the verse, for the blood pollutes, yachnif, the land. For the blood pollutes, or yachnif, the land. Pasuk in Bamidbar Numbers 35:33. Rabbi Yoshia says, the word yachnif is an acrostic for yichon af, the anger will dwell in the land. Sorry, it's not the company. I just need some oxygen. See Yalkut Shimoni, chapter 1, subsection 788. This midrash states explicitly that anger dwells on the land where there is bloodshed. Tapa 324. This is also why the above-cited Mishnah forbids us to derive benefit from anything that causes man to stumble. How many thousands, tens of thousands, and hundreds of thousands of evil spirits remain in these lands upon which our fellow Jews have stumbled in recent times? According to this Yalkut, all of these lands are filled with anger because of all the blood that was spilled in them. How can we remain here any longer? For the same reason, our forefathers were expelled from Spain did not want to return, even after the decrees ended. Therefore, one should not become blinded or enticed by a good business opportunity that he might find here, for he will not see any blessing from it. An evil spirit rests on it, and in the end, it will be to his detriment, God forbid. I said this long ago about individuals who use bribes and protectionism to remain in place for which practically all the Jews were expelled. Remain in places from which practically all the Jews were expelled. They use the prevailing market conditions to amass huge sums of money. Others take advantage of wartime market conditions to become wealthy. However, they forget that the Creator of the universe sent these afflictions to awaken us, his children, to leave the lands of exile and yearn to return to our forefathers' inheritance. They do not understand this. They have fattened their hearts and become engrossed in accumulating wealth to the great business opportunities that have developed during these turbulent times. Nothing will come out of this but disappointment. I cited a midrash about the plague of locusts to prove this. What's the meaning of the verse, not a single locust remains, in Shmos, chapter 10, verse 19? Rabbi Yochanan said, when the locusts came, the Egyptians rejoiced, saying, we will gather them and fill barrels with them. God retorted, you wicked ones, you're happy with the plague that I have brought upon you? Immediately the Lord turned a very strong west wind and it carried toward the Nile. And it carried the locusts, rather. Hashem turned a very strong west wind and it carried the locusts. What does it mean not a single locust remains? That is, even the ones that were salted in their pots and barrels flew away. Last page for today. The same is true of those who rejoice over the market conditions that have resulted from today's misfortunes. Topic 325. The Holy One says to them, "You're happy with the plague that I have brought upon you? I swear by your lives that you will remain empty-handed, because the wind will carry everything away." Similarly, we must not expect anything from the market conditions that will arise after the war. The only outcome of these misfortunes should be that we leave the diaspora, go up to the cities of Zion, and dwell therein. There we will succeed and attain everlasting peace and acknowledgement. This is God's will. I've provided everything at length. This is Hashem's will, as I proved above at length. Last paragraph. That's going to be it, because it's 2:00. So he is very, very adamant that no matter what's going to be after the war, good business opportunities, can make a lot of money, don't do it, rather move to Israel, you won't have anything left. Like God removed every single locust from Egypt, didn't let them have a single one to munch on. Same thing over here. We have to leave according to Retaktel. We must leave the diaspora immediately, resettle in Israel, and don't make the claim, "Oh my, this is going to be a wonderful thing. I'll stay here in the Chutz Laaretz and I'll make a lot of money." Because after the war, there's plenty of work to be done. There's plenty of business opportunity. Maybe, but not our job. So let me thank everybody for coming out. Thank you so much. Hopefully you enjoyed Rabbi Lichtenstein's conversation, Rabbi Sabato. You enjoyed hearing a little bit about Professor Rabbi Isidore Twersky. And we did a few pages of Eim Abanim Smecha. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be off next week. It's Rosh Hashanah. And then I do believe that we can theoretically be on Monday afternoon, because I think Yom Kippur is going to be falling Tuesday night and all day Wednesday. So therefore, Monday afternoon is a possibility for me. So if it's okay with you, we will, God willing, meet in the spirit of learning Torah and improving and increasing in these last days of the year, and then in the associated tshuva, keeping it real, showing it's for real. So we cannot meet next week, but we will in 2 weeks. I wish everybody a good, healthy, happy new year. I want to thank every single one of you for calling in throughout the year. I'm told 17,000 plus call in every single week. My wife thinks it's closer to about 7 or 8 people. But even 7 or 8 Jewish people are worth it. I want to thank all 7 of you, or all 17,000 of you, for calling in every single week. Hopefully you're enjoying this. Truth is, we're going to be done with this book before you know it. You might as well cop it right now and tell your friends. I wish you a healthy, happy, successful year filled with good health, a long life, a wonderful, peaceful, productive, Torah-filled, nachas-filled life. On the second day of the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, we bench everybody from the pulpit with everything that they need, and we're going to do it again this year. If you're in Cincinnati, join us at Gulf Manor Synagogue. Again, wishing everybody a healthy and a happy. And God willing, we'll meet tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday. And I wish everybody a good day. If you can't make it tomorrow, no problem. Have a wonderful week and an excellent Shabbos preceding. It's going to be the last Shabbos of the year. So make it a great one. Thank you so much all for coming out. Have a good, healthy day and a good, healthy, happy Nachasfield. Success and Torah-filled New Year. Take care and be well. Go my love. All the best.